Hello, and welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. I'm Rustin, and I'm here with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Aaron.
Every couple of weeks, Aaron and I will get together to talk about some really, really interesting topic in the world of ecology, evolution, and natural history. And this time around, we're discussing lakes. It's a topic that I suggested, and that was mainly because, you know, they're a really popular vacation area, and I think that they'd make for a nice summertime topic.
That's exactly what I thought, too, when I was thinking of lakes. A nice warm one. I wasn't thinking, you know, like the frigid north.
Well, even the frigid north is kind of nice in the summer, you know? The water's refreshing. You get a nice 70, 75 degree day.
It depends how north you're going, like Lake Baikal in Russia. I thought about doing that one, but it wasn't a summery episode.
Fair. But like lakes in New England and Minnesota in the summer are gorgeous.
Yeah, but I'd rather be down south, somewhere warm.
But not in the summer, though, because it's no longer warm. That's just apocalyptically hot.
No, but that's what the lake's for. Good place to cool off. Up in the north, I mean, you're hoping for the hottest day possible just so you can enjoy the lake.
Except that down south, the lake gets up to like the temperature of a bathtub, so you jump in and just feel kind of gross.
All right, but we'll settle for a nice middle ground. Maryland.
Yes, come to the lakes in Maryland, though we don't have very many.
We do not have a single naturally occurring lake.
This is true. So come to the lakes in Maryland, guys.
But it's the perfect spot for them, you know, is warm, but it'll be hot in the summer. But the lakes will be just cool enough to be refreshing. You don't have to worry about the lakes being too hot also. It's a perfect balance, if you will. Anyways, what do you have for me today?
All right. So, as we've been discussing, typically when people think about lakes, they generally think of wholesome family fun. You know, kayaking, canoeing, fishing. Basically just making family memories that will last a lifetime. And that's great. It's fantastic. I did a lot of that as a kid with my family. Very cherished memories. Well, thing is, on this show, I like to subvert expectations. So I'm going to be talking about a lake that is as polar opposite of that as you could possibly imagine. So let me set the scene. We are in northwest Cameroon in August 1986. Specifically, we're along a small chain of mountains. And in the middle of the night, a silent killer rolls down the side of the mountain. This killer took out nearly everything in its path, which included the 3,500 livestock, countless birds and insects, and also about 1,800 people. Do you have any idea what this killer could be?
Radon? I don't know.
It's not a bad guess. The killer was actually a concentrated cloud of carbon dioxide, and it came from a body of water called Lake Nyos. So, why was this lake the source of killer carbon dioxide gas? Well, that happens to be because of volcanic activity, because these aren't just your average mountains. These volcanoes have been active for about 110 million years, from the time when South America originally separated from Africa. The lake itself was actually formed through an explosion, specifically when groundwater made contact with magma, which caused it to blow up. This, in turn, created this very large crater, which, over time, filled with water and created the lake. And geologists believe that the lake formed as recently as 400 years ago. So it's not that old. Now, Lake Nyos sits along the edge of an inactive volcano with a pocket of magma sitting close to the surface. The carbon dioxide gas from the magma seeps through the crust and eventually into the lake itself. The gas dissolves into the water of the lake, but it remains contained by the pressure at the bottom, so it doesn't diffuse or escape. So kind of think of it like the carbonation in a soda can, right? It just kind of stays trapped in solution at the bottom of this lake. But after a while, the carbon dioxide reaches a critical mass within the lake, causing it to all erupt at once and explode, right? And at this time, when the carbon dioxide is released from the lake, it then goes cascading down the mountain. So, in other words, this is a recurring phenomenon, which in turn has led to some pretty interesting legends and practices in this area.
And you're telling me this is a silent killer?
Yes.
I would imagine there's some sort of satisfying pop fizz noise as this all rises to the surface at once.
Well, sure, but that's just in the area around the lake. This affected a pretty large area around this mountain range.
I don't know. It just sounds like it'd be louder to me.
I mean, sure, it was. It was. I'm assuming it was very loud, but again, the noise was mostly unnoticed. And then once the noise initial explosion happens, right, the gas just kind of rolls down the mountain. And I mean, air doesn't make much noise, so.
Yeah, that's true. It's not like you could see it coming.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, according to some Cameroonian myths, lakes themselves are, just in general, are said to contain ancestors and spirits, and in some cases, the lakes are even a source of death. Lakes are also said to suddenly change, which can include them rising, falling, sinking, or even changing locations entirely. And given how Lake Nyos was formed, it's pretty easy to see where that comes from, right? It honestly seems like less of a myth and more like an accurate description of the lakes in this area, because you can just have an explosion that forms a crater that eventually fills in with water, and boom, you have a lake.
Yeah.
So, the other thing is that people who live near lakes decree that their houses should be built a few feet off the ground to protect from the spirits within the lakes, which, again, is easy to understand, because CO2 has a higher density than the air we breathe. It sinks, right? It remains closer to the ground. So building a house off the ground protects the people inside from any CO2 gas that might erupt from a lake in the area. Another legend specific to Lake Nyos says that at one point, a man was actually leading people across the lake. And to get them across, he, you know, parted the lake, like Moses in the biblical story. However, once the group was about halfway across, I am not making this up, a mosquito bit him on the testicle, and he lost his concentration. As he lost his concentration, the lake suddenly filled in, and everyone drowned. But their spirits remained trapped within the lake. And so, according to local folklore, they can still be heard if you're close to the water. Just because of a mosquito who bit a guy in the wrong spot.
You can still hear his last words. Youch!
Yes, precisely. I mean, yeah, I don't blame the guy. That sounds like it would be really... It's painful. Anyway, but in the aftermath of this 1986 disaster, geologists eventually pieced together the mystery of the lake, including the volcanic activity and the buildup of CO2. And so this led to a really complicated question, which was, you know, the lake itself is a silent killer, or mostly silent killer. So when would the next disaster happen? Or better yet, is there a way to prevent it from happening at all? And they had to ask this question because people wanted to inhabit the area, right? It has really fertile soil, so it's really good for farmland. So as soon as, you know, some time passed and people, you know, started looking at the area around the lake, they wanted to live there, but it had to be safe. So posing this question to you, if you're going to diffuse carbon dioxide from the bottom of a volcanic lake, how do you think you should do it?
Maybe a really long stick. You kind of give it a poke, and you know when like someone has to start a fire, and you know, or they're bad at it, and it's like, all right, Terrence, you know, throwing some gasoline, and there's the one guy who like throws in the cup, and then he runs away quickly.
Wait, why is this person who's bad at fires named Terrence?
I just picked a name. We've been over this before. I just pull names out of nowhere.
for the record, when we record, he's on camera. I can see what he's doing. So sometimes I just think he has like a little hat off to the side that I can't see, and he's just pulling a piece of paper out.
No, it's just, anyway, some guy named Terrence, you know, he starts a fire and then he runs quickly because, you know, then it goes whoop. I imagine it's kind of like that. They send an intern out there with a really long stick to poke the bubble, and then they tell him to start booking it.
You know, that's not a bad guess at all. And you'll understand why once I tell you how they actually did solve the problem. But first, I'm going to talk about some failed proposals that they had. One of which was just to blow it up. Just drop a bomb on the lake, and that would cause a chain reaction, which would set off the CO2. Obviously, they'd clear out the area around the lake before they did this, and then let the CO2 roll down the mountain, diffuse, and then the area around the lake would once again be habitable. Obviously, this is pretty dangerous, so they decided not to do it. Option number two was to neutralize it with lime. And by lime, I mean calcium hydroxide, not citrus fruit. This, as it turned out, was too expensive. They wouldn't be able to buy enough lime to diffuse all the carbon dioxide in the lake because there's a massive amount that builds up in here. Enough to kill, again, 1,800 people. So another option was to dig a series of tunnels under the lake to release the gas that way. So you'd essentially drill this hole into the bottom of the lake, and that would allow for the gas to escape, and you diffuse it that way. It's all done. As it turns out, this was even more expensive than the lime, so they didn't do that either. The solution they did, in fact, put in place, which is so far working, at least for the last, 40 years or so, was to run a series of pipes from the bottom of the lake to the surface, which would release the gas slowly at the surface at, a relatively harmless rate. If you release the CO2 at a slow rate, then it just diffuses into the air and it's fine. But if you have that explosion where a bunch erupts at once, then it becomes deadly to people. So essentially, they created like this slow rolling geyser with these pipes. So when you said they should send an intern out there with a stick to poke the bubble, you weren't that far off.
Hey, if it works, it works.
It's just that it was a pipe instead of a stick. But that's basically what they did.
Still use the intern. He had to put in the place. Poor guy.
Yeah, exactly. He's got to go to the bottom of a lake now.
Always gets hazed on everything. Last week, they sent him on a snipe hunt. And before that, he had to go to the hardware store to pick up some blinker fluid.
Anyway, so hopefully this keeps the residents around Lake Nyo safe for years and years to come. And that's my piece.
Well, so, it's really cool. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just something I came across when I was, just looking up different really interesting lakes. And
all right, be honest. Did you look up deadliest lakes?
No.
Okay.
I looked up coolest lakes.
Okay.
But in any case, this one would have popped up either way. So
is it still like managed to this day? Has there been any more issues?
No issues, but it's still being managed. The pipe system is still in place. And it's slowly releasing the gas from the bottom of the lake. So hopefully that keeps the residents of the area safe.
Yeah. Maybe they could turn around to make a profit.
How?
You can sell carbon dioxide.
To whom?
Yeah. It's used in fish tanks. For fertilizer. You buy canisters of it to have it diffuse.
Really?
And airsoft. Airsoft and paintball. You get CO2 cartridges fire the munitions. I can't say it's a big market, but it is one. Maybe they could sell it as a souvenir.
Yeah.
I've had better ideas.
Yeah.
They could say it's an organic CO2 farm, from our pipe to your table.
Yeah, because that's what people like to hear. From our pipe to your table. Wow, that sounds like somebody's being served sewage.
Oh, that's ExxonMobil's slogan.
Anyway, what have you got for me?
Okay, so I got a little bit of a build up. I will say, when I started this, it went a very different direction than how I thought it was going to go.
Okay.
All right. So summer's coming up, like you said, and people are going to want to go for a swim, preferably, you know, in a nicer environment, not one that's filled with deadly CO2. So they're probably going to hit up the beach instead of that. And when they're at the beach, there's going to be one thing they're on the lookout for, and that's sharks. And in the case of lakes, that's not something you usually should be worried about. Sharks are saltwater animals. Lakes are freshwater. Not an issue.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to be in Lake Nicaragua.
Because I've heard about
they have a population of freshwater sharks. Yep.
Yes.
So I'm going to discuss their shark population. I wanted to talk about their ecology and like what their unique environment can tell me about the sharks here. But instead, it kind of made me look at sharks as a whole and why they are or are not in some areas. So
interesting. Okay.
Yeah, this is a different one. I had a different idea going in. Anyways, we'll start off. Lake Nicaragua. This is the largest lake in Central America. It's over 3,000 square miles, but it only has a max depth of about 90 feet. Which is really not that deep for a lake.
No, not at all.
That is very shallow.
I think, I'll have to look it up to double check, but I think Lake Nyos might be deeper than Lake Nicaragua, despite being a fraction of the size.
Yeah, like, put in perspective, like, Great Lakes, several hundred feet deep. Like, it gets much deeper than that. 90 feet is pretty shallow.
Yeah, okay, yeah, Lake Nyos is almost 700 feet deep.
Yeah, okay, so much deeper. So this is not a deep lake at all.
Several times over, yes.
So not a huge volume of water, but a pretty big surface area. It does cover a decent chunk.
Right, okay.
So historically, it supported a variety of industries, such as shipping, fishing, and at some points, piracy. Again, it's a very large lake, so there's ports all around it. And as for the lake itself, it supports a variety of different fish species.
Wasn't this...
Some are expected.
Wasn't this lake once being considered as part of an Atlantic to Pacific shipping channel before they built the Panama Canal?
It was proposed at one point.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Because it is in Central America where it's at a pretty skinny bit of land in the grand scheme of things. But it is north of Panama, and Panama was ultimately easier.
Got it. Okay.
And I will say, if that did happen, like the biological destruction of the lake would be severe because you have all these species on one side reaching the other.
Right.
But I'll get to that. But yeah, you are right. It was considered. The lake itself supports a variety of different fish species. Some of these you would expect, like many different types of cichlids. There's a lot of them in Central and South America. Mm-hmm. And some are unexpected because Lake Nicaragua is home to sharks, sawfish, and tarpon. Tarpon are a very large, typically marine species of fish, popular game fish. All these are typically associated with saltwater oceans, not freshwater lakes. So it's a big question is about these sharks, where they came from, how they live here, and you know what adaptations do they have to live in this lake?
Yeah.
And I'll backtrack a little bit to explain the topic of salinities. Just a little bit of background of why you can't just put one fish in one body of water into another. So seawater is salty, of course, and has a much higher salinity than freshwater. So let's say you have a grape. If I put that grape in salt water, the grape will shrivel up because it has a different osmolarity than the solution it's in. There is less salt in the grape than there is in the salt water, so the water is going to move out from the grape, and it'll kind of shrivel up. Whereas if I have the opposite situation, I have a grape and I put it in 100% pure fresh water, that grape is saltier than the water around it and it might expand so much it actually explodes. That can happen with cells in a body when they're in different osmolarities. They have to adjust, have to acclimate. So you can't just put a fish from fresh water into salt water or the opposite way around. You're going to get major issues. It's going to kill the fish, you know. There are many fish that can migrate between the two, but it has to be a gradual process of acclimation. You can't just plop them into a bucket of the other and expect it to be fine. That's a no-go. So that's kind of why these sharks originally were thought to be like an anomaly. Originally, it was proposed that these sharks were actually Pacific species that worked their way into the bay And over time, through volcanic activity, this bay closed up, formed the lake, and gradually became freshwater. Because Lake Nicaragua, again, Central America, it is skinny, but Lake Nicaragua is actually much closer to the Pacific Ocean. It's right by it. Now, these sharks have been documented in the lake as far back as the 1500s, with many accounts showing that they were not a rare occurrence. So it was like a true population you found there rather than a few isolated individuals. They were originally called Carcharias nicaraguensis, which translates to sharp teeth from Nicaragua. Early studies, of course, claim that these were originally from the Pacific Ocean. Nicaragua is in Central America, and like I said, it's going to be closer to that. But this theory was not well constructed, even though it was held for a good period. Several years, this was kind of just the idea. That's how the lake formed, and this is where the sharks came from. And there's a big hang-up on this. I mentioned three notable species found in this lake that are found in marine environments. Tarpon, sawfish, and sharks. The sawfish in this lake resembled species from the Caribbean. That's on the Atlantic side. The tarpon were identical to tarpon in the Caribbean. And tarpon are only found in the Atlantic Ocean. They're not found in the Pacific Ocean. And lastly, the Lake Nicaragua sharks were found to be identical to a certain species in the Atlantic. And it turns out they weren't their own species. They were one known as Carcharinus lucus. But you're probably more familiar with their common name, bull sharks.
Oh, yep. Okay.
They were actually just bull sharks the entire time. They were never their own species. So if you know anything about bull sharks, you should know that they are well known for their ability to survive in fresh water. This is a very common thing for them. And this is, as I was reading more, this is the point where I kind of realize, oh, I'm going down like the wrong path. Because I thought it was its own species and I was going to talk about its evolution, how it got there. But I knew of this topic before I started actually reading about it. And then I realized, oh, wait, no, that's not true at all. This was largely debunked in the 60s. A paper came out by Thorson et al. And they blew apart the Pacific origin right out of the water. But that does raise the question, how do they get there? And again, this is even dumber how at one point they were considered to come from the Pacific Ocean, because Lake Nicaragua feeds right into the Atlantic Ocean. It's part of the San Juan drainage basin. They're connected. I don't know why they thought it came from the other ocean at all. There's no connection to that side.
Well, proximity, I guess.
Yeah, but okay. It is closer by proximity, but none of those animals were even found in the other ocean. So I don't know. It's like one of those things where someone came up with it and everyone just rolled with it until someone actually thought, hey, wait a minute, that doesn't really make sense.
I don't know. Maybe they thought that God just was splashing around in his largest bathtub, the Pacific Ocean, and then just kind of bumped the edge and all of a sudden a bunch of water flew over into Lake Nicaragua and carried some sharks and tarpon with it,
Yeah. Whoops. Yeah, maybe. A big wave took them over.
Yeah, well, I hope they can survive in fresh water. Yikes.
So, bull sharks have been found to migrate into the lake on multiple occasions. Individuals have been tracked to migrate from Costa Rica into the lake. The sharks are not landlocked at all. They do this multiple times. All the way out from the Caribbean into the lake. So, they go upstream and downstream again. In fact, tracking shows it only takes them about a week or two to complete this journey. It's pretty doable for them. It's pretty much like a salmon. They can even hop their way up rapids in some points.
Oh, there's a skill. But not when there are bears at the top. That tends to complicate things.
Well, maybe not if you're a shark. At that point, it might be even fights.
I don't know. I'd take a bear over a shark flopping around in the rapids, personally. I think the bear wins that one.
Okay, well, let's say it's like about 2 feet of water and it's a bull shark. They got more room to maneuver.
Okay, but if it's 2 feet of water, you're not going to have rapids. You're not going to have serious riffling rapids that require the shark to flop around.
It's not like they're going up waterfalls, but there are rapids at some parts of this river and they can move their way up it. They're not shooting up waterfalls like a salmon. It's not that extreme. Oh. And if it was, imagine the sight that would be. because they're adult bull sharks that make their way into
this
lake.
I was imagining that site. That's why I brought bears into this, Aaron. And now I know that that's not the case, and I'm disappointed.
Yeah, maybe I hyped it up a bit too much. So, to adjust to freshwater, bull sharks are capable of modifying their internal salt concentrations. Again, that's a big deal. So, when they live in freshwater, the salt concentrations in their blood are much less than bull sharks that are living in salt water. They could decrease the sodium and the chloride in their blood. They still face a risk of overhydration due to freshwater still having much less sodium than the sharks. So, to compensate for this, they just pee a lot more frequently and with a lot more diluted urine. And this combination allows them to survive in freshwater.
I just kind of want to impress the fact that that is like an actual like superpower. A lot of like almost no other fish can do what the bull sharks do. Like, that's such a rare feat to be able to move from salt to freshwater. Because being in saltwater is such a specifically evolved set of characteristics. And then the same with freshwater, too, because you have to avoid being overhydrated. And so to be able to transfer between the two effectively is insane.
Yeah, it is very impressive what they can do. And like I said, for fish, it is fairly rare, especially to this degree, because they can kind of do it as they please.
Yeah.
Most fish that migrate like this, it is a set point of their life that they're doing it. Like salmon. The adults are going back in the freshwater. They breed and they die. They can't go in and out as they feel like it.
You know, the only other thing I know that they can do this is like Aquaman. Like, it's crazy.
Another one is really lame superpowers. Hey, you talk the fish, the water does the talking. So... your first, or at least my first thought about this, was that these guys are probably like salmon. They migrate in to breed and then they leave. That's not the case. In fact, baby bull sharks are probably too small to adapt to the freshwater. They need better developed kidneys. They need to get a bit larger before they can handle these shifts in salinities. So the pups will develop in estuary habitats where there's a lot more resources, and then they'll move into the lake as needed.
So they just kind of mosey between the lake and the ocean as adults?
They do what they want. Bull sharks are very widespread, and they're very opportunistic. I mean, they're found essentially on every continent except Antarctica. They kind of go where they see fit. Wow. It's the best way to describe them.
Real outlaw cowboy types.
So there's not a lot of studies. There's not a lot of studies in this century about these sharks. Most of it was from like the 60s and 70s when they were finally figuring out that, oh, these are just bull sharks. And, oh, they just migrate up the river. I did find one on their diets. So both adults and adolescents will live in the lake. The young will feed on smaller fish species like the cichlids that I mentioned, whereas the adults will feed on larger fish like tarpon, sawfish, smaller bull sharks, turtles, birds, and even mammals. The occasional sloth was found in their diet. There were some reports that they would, like, snatch dogs from the shore. And I think even occasionally, like, a clump of bananas that fell off, like, a shipping container. But these weren't really documented. These were more, like, I wouldn't even say historical accounts. Like, someone saw it a long time ago and it kind of passed around.
Oh, okay. So, wait, the bananas, quote-unquote, fell off the shipping container? Is that what the sharks told you, Aaron?
No, I bet it's a bored dock worker.
Hmm.
And it just pitched it in.
Okay. Seems fishy. No pun intended.
Yes. Fishy. Mm-hmm. So bull sharks are incredibly diverse in their diets. They've been documented feeding on all sorts of fish, crabs, sea urchins, squid, mammals, other sharks, rays, worms, clams, not even food. In other parts of the world, bull sharks can be key predators on shark species or rays. So they'll, in some areas, they'll feed a lot on dogfish, which are a smaller shark species, so much that they're actually key in maintaining biodiversity of the smaller prey species by feeding on like the meso predators. So they kind of regulate the ecosystem in that regard.
So they're like the apex predator.
Well, in some areas, they're scavengers. And they prefer just to eat whale corpses.
Huh. So they're really just...
Yeah, they have a wide range.
They're really just whatever you need them to be.
That's the thing about bull sharks is they are adapted to... They will eat whatever they can. They get by. They are tough. They are resilient. So they can fill out different niches depending on what other shark species there are in the area. Or depending on what habitat they're in.
They're like the shark equivalent of Charlie Kelly. They just... Doesn't matter if they're just like living under a bridge, drinking bleach. They'll get by. They'll survive. They'll find a way.
They make do. They always scrape by in the end. So, like I said, some areas they feed primarily on whale corpses. I found that one was caught in the Chesapeake Bay and stomach contents revealed it was feeding almost primarily on eels. Like it was specializing on eels, which again, eels migrate into the bay. So,
sure.
I guess there were a lot of them.
Yeah.
In some parts of Africa, they have been known to occasionally attack young hippos, which is a very much like a two worlds collide sort of thing.
And no one's made a movie about it?
There's probably a sci-fi movie. We already have Sharktopus, so it right. could go up against a no robo-hippo.
No one's made Shark to Hippo yet?
Shark to Hippo? Oh, you know, combine them.
Sharktopotamus.
Okay, that's much better.
Sharktopotamus, there it is.
I don't know how frequent this is. I imagine it's quite rare, but just goes to show you how wide-ranging these are. And unfortunately, these sharks have attacked people. They're one of the most common offenders, following, they're just behind tiger sharks and, of course, the great white shark. The great white shark, of course, it prefers to feed on seals, and a surfer does resemble a seal from below. But in the case of bull sharks, it's kind of just them going after whatever. They're not targeting people. They will eat whatever. And that's what the study in Lake Nicaragua concluded. They will eat anything. Smaller sharks eat smaller fish because they're small. Larger sharks pretty much eat anything because they can. Why it seemed like there were clear trends in other parts of the world more or less seems random in this lake. They do regularly scavenge, which explains why they've been documented eating mammals like sloths and birds. But they'll also consume items like sticks, rocks, a glass bottle, and orange peels, which are all completely inedible to a shark. also, a lot of leaves. So,
well, you never know until you try, right?
In Lake Nicaragua, it seems, according to this paper, the preferred mode of feeding is scavenging for the sharks. They would rather just... They prefer to find dead prey, but they'll eat whatever they can.
Is it still prey if it's dead? like prey implies that like you gotta capture it somehow, right? Like, no? Like, if it's already dead, well, it's just...
Yeah, I guess it's not prey then.
It's just lying there, you know? Like,
yeah.
Vultures are birds of prey only because they're closely related to birds that do prey on other things. Whereas...
Yeah, I guess, okay, they aren't scavenging prey, they're... Scavenging corpses, the leftovers.
They're just going through the back of the fridge.
There we go, full circle. That was the first episode of this season.
Yeah, exactly.
So, according to this paper, the preferred mode of feeding is scavenging, of course. Especially in the San Juan River, where the water is extremely turbid, there's very little visibility here. This makes sight hunting difficult for the sharks, so going after live prey might not be in the cards for them. But it still allows them to navigate based on smell, meaning that dead animals is the way to go. Or, you know, like worms or arthropods, something at the bottom. They're still more than capable of hunting live prey like fish, though.
Gotcha. So, but they rely pretty heavily on sight in saltwater?
So, this paper is an old paper. This goes back to the 70s, and I really haven't found much since then. But they discussed a similar species, a lemon shark, and how lemon sharks rely heavily on sight and scent combined. They utilize both these aspects. And I imagine bull sharks do as well.
Okay.
And then I mentioned in this case, you know, the water's so turbid, they can't possibly see things. So, scent... olfactory and then lateral line system will be how they sense their way around.
Got it. Okay.
And now it kind of gives me to the point, Lake Nicaragua has these bull sharks that they migrate in and out of the lake. They're not breeding in the lake, but they're always present. So why is this lake so special? Why is this the shark lake? It kind of is special and isn't special at the same time. And this is where I started doing a bit more digging into the topic of freshwater bull sharks. And this is where we're kind of changing gears to. So I mentioned that they're known for their ability to live in both freshwater and brackish environments. Bull sharks are found in many river systems all across the globe. This includes countries like the US, Brazil, India, Australia, South Africa, and many more. Bull sharks have been documented 4,000 miles upstream in the Amazon River.
Wow, yeah.
And they've been found in the Potomac River in Maryland.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
It's not that rare a sight, actually. I mean, occasionally a monster comes up and, you know, that makes the news, but it's not that rare in the grand scheme of things. I mean, maybe if it's like by DC, that'd be a bit more rare.
Yeah.
But yeah. In fact, my dad got a photo of one at Piney Point, which is in southern Maryland, where he was hunting cow nose rays. Really cool photo. I got to get it on iNaturalist sometime. It was right by the dock, too. He got great picture of it. Probably the most extreme case of a bull shark migrating upriver was in 1937, where two fishermen caught a bull shark in Afton, Illinois, in the Mississippi River.
What?
Yeah, a bull shark in Illinois. It's about 5 feet long.
What?
Why it went up there? I don't know.
So you're, but it did. You're telling me that these two dudes in Illinois had more successful shark fishing times in Illinois than I have ever had in the actual ocean?
You know what? Yeah. Well, really stings, doesn't it?
It really does.
Although,
that's a serious...
Imagine the stories they told at the bar that night. Because they got a photo with it, too.
Oh, God. That fishing story is amazing. That's like the best fishing story. Hey, let me tell you about the shark I caught in Illinois. Nothing tops that.
So another circumstance with these bull sharks is sometimes there's a flooding event or a hurricane, and they'll kind of get stuck in freshwater or brackish environments. An example is Lake... with Pontchartrain?
Oh, yeah.
Pontchartrain?
Pontchartrain, yeah.
Pontchartrain. I did pronounce it right. In Louisiana.
Right near New Orleans, yep.
Oh, yeah, right by New Orleans. After Hurricane Katrina, you know, a couple made their way into there. The most extreme case I found is Australia in the Carrbrook Golf Course, where several bull sharks live year-round in a lake. They came in from a flood in 96, and they've... been there ever since. And they've been adopted by the golf club.
Is their logo now a shark or something?
Yes, it is. They make merchandise out of them. They're the club mascots. They host a shark-themed tournament.
Oh, that's
like,
amazing.
They have all this merchandise. They love the sharks there.
That's fantastic.
It does take the meaning of water hazard to a whole new level.
Oh, no, I want to go get my ball. No, you don't.
No, you don't. Yeah, they no longer pull golf balls out of that lake. I know Florida has its golf course gators, but Australia has got sharks. I mean, you can't top that.
Well, of course, when it comes to, you know, naturally occurring hazards, there are very few places that top Australia. At least naturally occurring living hazards.
There is another flood, and locals were actually worried that the sharks may have left during this opportunity because the course is near two rivers that, of course, feed into the ocean.
Sure.
So they thought maybe the sharks decided to just pack up and leave. And fortunately, they showed up again and everyone was happy.
Oh, yay. And
they're still alive and well in the lake, and they're even fed on occasions. It's not a ton of sharks in there. It's just a couple. And I don't know. I know it's not a true breeding population of them.
No.
But they're there and they're happy and everyone loves them. So... why not?
Yeah, that's awesome. It's rare that you hear about sharks being beloved by people instead of, you know, hated and killed.
Maybe it's an Australia thing. They're just used to everything.
That's true. I mean, when you live with scorpions and about 9 of the planet's 10 most deadly snakes, you know, who cares about a bull shark?
Yeah, if anything, that's the best thing to have in a lake because you know it can't bother you unless you go in the lake. Crocodiles are a different story. You know, that could get you when you aren't paying attention. But sharks don't go in the water. They got signs. You know it's there. So I mentioned all this. We know that bull sharks go in the freshwater all the time, and they are found all across the world. Why don't we have shark-infested lakes everywhere?
Do you want me to guess?
You can't, because there's no clear answer to this. I'm going to propose my own theory.
Off the top of my head, my theory is that a lot of lakes can't support a fish of that size. Well, sharks get pretty big, so if one just kind of gets swept into a lake, chances are, you know, once the flood, you know, regresses, the lake in which the bull shark is now contained doesn't have enough, you know, prey to sustain it.
Absolutely. That's one of the three reasons I came up with.
Okay.
So, yeah, a lot of these lakes don't have enough to support a large population or any population. So you need several individuals. You probably need, you know, close to 100 sharks to have a population. There's not a lot of lakes that can support that, especially if they're going to be trapped in there. So that's one. Another thing, bull sharks are migratory. So you can find them all along the eastern half of the U.S., but they migrate south during the winter for warmer waters. They don't stay up there. So any lake up north is not suitable habitat for bull sharks. They're going to move back down. Maryland is part of that. They don't stay in Maryland. Even though you can find them like pretty far up into the bay on some occasions, they're not going to live there. And this does also remove the theory of sharks living in the Great Lakes. That's one I've seen a couple times. They can't live up there year round, even though it is a very large lake. Actually, it's not that productive in the grand scheme of things. Although it maybe could support a shark population, a very small one, they're not going to thrive there. So bull sharks are very opportunistic. They do frequently go into fresh water. This is usually a river system where it forms estuaries because that's where the young will be, you know, a coastal estuarine environment, maybe at the mouth of a river or at the base of a bay. They don't want to be trapped in the freshwater lake, especially when they get 10 plus feet long. So they want to be able to move in and out. And that's kind of the trickiest part. There are a lot of barriers in a modern era. We have dams, locks, canals, pollution, urban expansion. There are a lot of physical barriers that make it hard for large sharks to enter and leave a freshwater lake.
Lake Nicaragua is in a tropical area, so they don't have to deal with the cold temperatures that they would in a lake like, you know, Lake Michigan.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, that's kind of the three things I thought. So Lake Nicaragua has a combination of, well, one, it's in a warm environment. They can live there year round. Two, it's easy for them to get in and out. And three, they're not a true breeding lake population. They move out to the ocean as they please. And that's the thing. They're breeding out in the ocean. So they kind of need access to go in and out to have an abundance in this lake. They're not locked in the lake and they're not even breeding in the lake. So when you combine all those factors, it really restricts the amount of areas you can get these sharks. Again, there's always exceptions. You know, you get stray bull sharks that get really far inland. And of course, like I said, flooding events, they can get stuck in lakes and they can live in these lakes for a while, or, you know, maybe someone picks them up and drops them in there. I think that was a plot of, yeah, it was a plot, Shark Night, a really shitty shark movie. Except that one was a saltwater lake, and the plot was a couple rednecks and a cop were buying sharks, putting them in the lake, putting GoPros on them, and then selling the footage online of them killing people.
What?
It wasn't a good movie. It was a bad movie.
I'm surprised it was greenlit. It's almost like they said the word shark and the executive producer went, say no more. You got your money.
Oh, that was in all the promos. It came out like, what, 2010s? They kept saying like, this is the shark movie. And they listed off all the sharks that appeared in this movie. It's like, we got all the shark species in this.
Oh, God.
That was like their claim to fame.
That's terrible. So okay,
it wasn't good.
But honestly, this lake just kind of sounds like Bull Shark College, you know, in that like, as, you know, as young, they live out in, like, you know, the lagoon around their parents. And then, like, after a while, they kind of get sent off on their own into a very large lake where they can kind of do their own thing for a while. And then once they get sick of that, they just come back out into the ocean.
Well, except that sometimes adults go in there.
They need adults to teach the college students, don't they?
You got me. Yeah, you need, like, maintenance crew.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah, cafeteria workers. Okay. All the faculty. Yeah, sure. It's like Bull Shark College. We can call it that.
Yes.
So Lake Nicaragua is not the only place you can find bull sharks in freshwater. Bull sharks are actually not even the most freshwater shark species. The Ganges shark is almost exclusively freshwater or brackish. But they're much smaller, limited range, not nearly as impressive as the bull shark. Right? No, they're interesting in their own right. I'll give them that. But bull sharks, you can find them everywhere. And it's a somewhat more unique situation where they can enter and exit this lake more easily. They can be there year-round as well. And while there are enough fish to support the sharks in the lake, it's not like it's a shark population that never leaves the lake. They do. Frequently. So, yeah, that's my piece. You can see how it kind of pivoted as I knew of this lake, but when I learned more about it, it changed my perspective on how I was going to talk about things. Kind of shifted to why this lake is the way it is, but then bull sharks as a whole. Like I said, very opportunistic. They kind of go wherever they can. They can fill a lot of different niches.
Right, right. Cool. That's awesome. Honestly, I kept thinking it was only a matter of time before one of us talked about bull sharks on this podcast because they're so cool.
They are, and I would visit them again. They are worth talking about again. I knew I wanted to talk about them at one point, and I didn't know that they were the sharks in Lake Nicaragua until I actually started doing the research.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, it's bull sharks now, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to talk about several lakes, too, including that golf course. That's fun.
Yeah, that golf course. You know, I thought, could this be its own topic? And then, no, not really. There was no actual research done in this lake. You just get news reports.
Man, I'm telling you, when they found sharks on their golf course, you know that, like, some manager came into a room with all the head staff for the golf course and was like, hey, guys, I got bad news. We got bull sharks in our lakes on the course. It's going to be a problem. But meanwhile, over in the corner, the head of the marketing department is sitting there going, thank you, God.
Oh, he got a major raise that day.
He's like, this course will sell itself. I don't even need to do anything.
Honestly, I don't play golf. I have no inclination to play golf.
Neither do I.
I would go to this
lake. I'd play golf there in a second. Are you kidding me?
Yep.
I would go to Australia just so I could play golf there. That sounds like so much fun.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, there's a lot more scenarios with these sharks going to freshwater environments. I was hard to fit it all into one piece. I could have just listed all the different events I found with them appearing. And unfortunately, they do attack people sometimes.
Right.
So there is that also. I know river monsters, they were like the repeat offender.
Yeah.
There's probably a bull shark in every season at least. And it was all different parts of the world, but it was the same species.
All right. Well, this is normally the part of the show where we talk about our next podcast, but I think this is going to be our last episode for this season of the Primordial Soup Pot.
Yep. Summer's coming up around the corner, and, well, Russ and I we do need a break. This takes time. We aren't making money off of it.
Right.
And, you know, we tend to travel a lot during the summer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we would like to keep up with our 2-week recording schedule, and it's kind of hard to do. But we will return in the fall.
Yes. Yeah. And like we said before, we took a break last year. This gives us an opportunity to look at potential topics and kind of plan things out a little bit more.
Absolutely.
So with that being said, do you want to take us out?
I'll take us out. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow or review on your podcast app of choice. If you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at Soup Pot Podcast on Twitter or theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
Sounds fantastic. And once again, thank you guys so much for sticking around for season 2. And we're excited to have you back for season 3 in the fall.
Yep.
But until then, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.